says he called Commissioner Bud Selig and Cardinals manager Tony La Russa earlier in the day to personally apologize. McGuire says that when he used steroids, he never imagined he would have to talk about it to national media. DePaul University has fired its basketball coach. Jerry Wainwright is being replaced on an interim basis by assistant Tracy Webster. Wainwright was in his fifth season at DePaul and had a record of 59-80. The Blue Demons 7-8 this season, 0-3 in the Big East. The Chicago Bulls host the Detroit Pistons tonight. The Bulls have won 6 of their last 8 at the United Center, while the Pistons are trying to halt a 12-game losing streak. Marian Hossa of the Chicago Blackhawks is listed as day-to-day with a lower body injury. He was scratched from the lineup and didn't play in last night's 3-1 loss to Anaheim. The Blackhawks have their first 2-game losing streak since late November now. They're off until Thursday when they host Columbus. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy the Moscow Festival Ballet's Coppelia, January 19th through 21st. More information can be found at KrannertCenter.com.
It's 2:41. A Cook County prosecutor wants a Northwestern professor and his students to hand over their grades and emails, notes, and course evaluations so that a prosecutor can review a murder conviction. David Protes is not just any professor. The reporting by his students has helped exonerate and free 11 men convicted of murders they did not commit. NPR's David Folkenflik reports.
David Protes got his start in the legendary world of Chicago journalism with undercover exposés of corruption. But since the early 1980s, he has also been training students at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism by having them re-report murder convictions where claims of innocence seem plausible.
They bring a fresh perspective to an old case. They bring an energy and zeal, and they're disarming interviewers. When they knock on someone's door, they don't see someone like me standing there. They see some young, idealistic college kids who want to find the truth. And often that's the first step toward getting it.
Take the Ford Heights Four. Four black youths from the housing projects who were arrested and convicted of abduction, rape, and murder in the killing of a young white couple on Chicago's South Side. Over months, students turned up evidence police had intimidated a key witness and prosecutors had buried another eyewitness account implicating four other men. Protest's students even got a confession from one of the real killers. Among those freed in 1996 was Kenneth Adams, who had served 18 years in prison. He shared in a $36 million settlement for wrongful imprisonment.
You know, without them stepping in and doing what they did, what chance would we have had? How much evidence would not have been uncovered? How many witnesses would not have been questioned and you know, you get the truth about it? They had done a whole lot of stuff that was very vital to putting the pressure on the state of Illinois to allow for the DNA testing.
A disclosure. My colleague, NPR correspondent Laura Sullivan, was among those student journalists who investigated the Ford Heights Four. In 2003, then-Governor George Ryan pointed to the work of the Northwestern students in commuting the sentence of every prisoner on death row. The current case involves the effort to exonerate Anthony McKinney, who was convicted of another decades-old killing. The region's chief prosecutor, Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez, says she's reviewing that case, but needs to put the methods of the Medill Innocence Project under the microscope, too. Normally, journalists in Illinois enjoy some protection about divulging their reporting methods, but Alvarez has said the students weren't really reporters. She says her office's review indicates the students' research was skewed.
The question of credibility has already arisen because several witnesses have given statements to the students, and when we talk to them, they have recanted those statements.
Alvarez's press aides suggested in several conversations they'd arrange an interview with NPR, but never made her available. So these comments are from an interview in November with Chicago Public Radio. In court papers, Alvarez says the Northwestern team gave a key witness $60 for the cab fare to a bus station. But after a short drive, he then appears to have split the money with the cabbie, gotten out, and spent his share on drugs. Alvarez suggested that payment was intended to get the witness to switch his story, and that students were eager to find proof of innocence in order to get good grades.
If these actions were taken, and if these statements were obtained that way, why would a student do that? Why would they go to this extreme to get a statement?
Paying someone $60 to incriminate themselves? Tilting the truth for grades? Protest says both claims are patently false, and that he'll never give up the grades, the notes, the emails, or anything else.
If we do that, we can't go out and cultivate sources and assure them that what they're telling us won't be given to prosecutors. Because in a lot of cases, people are talking off the record.
I met Protest at one of his favorite restaurants in Oak Park, a suburb west of Chicago.
Legally, what I take from it is that the prosecutors are on a fishing expedition. Practically, I think that they have an interest in paying back for years of embarrassment and paying forward to deter us.
Protest says he thinks back on the vindication of Kenny Adams and the others of the Ford Heights Four.
When Kenny was released, I said, "You're riding with me," and I deliberately took a route that crested on Lakeshore Drive, and he breathed in the lake breezes. And Kenny Adams that day saw the Lake Michigan for the first time in 18 years, and I saw it for the first time in my life.
Protest says his family jokes his phone number is on the wall of every prison cell in Illinois. He says he intends to keep answering the call. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
It's 2:46. For most people who get migraine headaches, light equals pain.
There's a stab of pain. It's an intensifying. Sometimes it can be to the point where you feel a wave of nausea come over you.
That's Heather Bird of Rochester, New York, who has a lot in common with other migraine patients who are sensitive to light, except for one thing. She's blind. NPR's John Hamilton tells us how a new study of blind patients like Bird has allowed researchers to finally explain how light becomes pain.
A genetic disorder has left Heather Bird with almost no vision, even though she's just 22.
I have very limited light perception.
Bird usually can't tell whether the world is bright or dim. But she says on some days, the difference becomes obvious.
If I have a migraine and I walk outside, even if I can't see that it's a sunny day versus an overcast day, I can go, "Oh, my headache just got worse. The sun must be out."
That sort of sensitivity to light got the attention of Rami Burstein, a migraine researcher at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He was part of a team that studied Bird and 19 other blind people who get migraines. It turned out that the people who'd lost their eyes entirely or who had damage to the optic nerve were not sensitive to light. But people like Bird were. Burstein says that suggested their eyes were still sending signals from a group of photoreceptor cells that was only discovered a few years ago.
These photoreceptors that make less than 1% of all the cells in the retina in the eye carry light signals to brain areas that have nothing to do with visual perception.
They don't help people see anything. Instead, these cells probably help the brain maintain things like circadian rhythms. Burstein suspected the signals from this small group of photoreceptors might be affecting migraine symptoms in people like Bird. To find out, his team did a series of experiments with rats. They traced the signals from these special light cells in the retina all the way to an area deep in the brain. It's an area that's not involved in vision.
It has something to do with pain, and it contains specifically neurons that are activated during migraine headache.
And that would explain how light could intensify the pain of a migraine even in someone who is blind. Burstein says the finding won't help doctors treat headaches directly, but it could lead to a drug that would let patients leave the confines of a dark room. And Burstein says that would be a big deal for all migraine sufferers.
It is, for many patients, the difference between reading or not reading, writing or not writing, working or not working, a lot of the things that keep their life normal.
Other researchers say finding these migraine cells deep in the brain may help explain how a wide range of sensory factors can increase migraine pain. Richard Lipton directs the Montefiore Headache Center at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York.
Some people are unusually sensitive to smells. They can't stand the smell of gasoline or perfume. Other people may be unusually sensitive to sound. Some people are unusually sensitive to movement.
Lipton says the new study won't necessarily lead to treatments for these people, but he says it should reassure them that they're not imagining things.
Knowing that unusual experiences in migraine have an established neurobiological basis, I think, is a great comfort to people.
The new research appears in the online edition of the journal Nature Neuroscience. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Stormwater runoff can be one of the main ways that urban areas create pollution. In some cases, it can dramatically suffocate marine life. It can also cause flooding. One small town in Maryland is on the receiving end of its region's runoff. As Sabri Benashour reports, it's trying to set a national example with its approach to solving the problem.
Anytime it rains, the ground in Edmundston, Maryland, quickly becomes waterlogged. Here's Bridget Pooley and her mother, Maggie.
When the river gets flooded with rainwater, for example, if it were to continue raining like this, it literally comes up all over.
And then all the debris that comes from upstream, all the municipalities upstream, as the water recedes, it just leaves milk cartons and trash tires everywhere.
Adam Ortiz is the mayor of this low-income, low-lying town of 1400. He says his town is a trap for stormwater runoff from all the paved surfaces in the area.
Anywhere between 35 and 56 homes would be underwater at least once every year because of all the flooding from parking lots and highways and shopping centers and streets.
So every year, dozens of homes are flooded. That's in part because 28% of the entire watershed in this region around Washington, D.C. is paved over. But flooding isn't the whole story.
If a watershed is more than 10% impervious, you're going to have impaired water quality.
Jim Connolly is executive director of the Anacostia Watershed Society. He says stormwater smothers or poisons aquatic life and causes erosion.
It's all the oil and the grease that comes out of our cars. It's any of the trash we throw on the streets, any of the fertilizers or the pesticides that we use in our lives here. Stormwater is it's the base cause of all the problems in our urban rivers.
So the town of Edmundston decided to do something about it. A new pumping station is keeping floods down, but the town wants to be a model for how to prevent stormwater runoff in the first place. So with Federal Recovery Act money, the town is rebuilding its main street from top to bottom. Mayor Ortiz sidesteps a bulldozer to show off what's now a construction site on the roadside.
This is a bioretention tree box. So instead of the water going into the drains and into the river, it will go directly into this bed.
In that bed will go native trees grown in gravel and compost to absorb and filter water. The street itself is going to be repaved with permeable concrete to let some water pass right through.
The water is going to filter naturally into the water table, so everything should be taken care of on-site like it was a few hundred years ago.
85 to 90% of runoff will be trapped by this system. But what about cost? Dominique Lukenhoff directs the Office of State and Watershed Partnerships for this region at the Environmental Protection Agency.
It is not more costly with regards to the refurbishing and additional greening of this street.
But this wouldn't have happened had this community not organized to fight for it. Alan Hance is with the Chesapeake Bay Trust. He says that to have a major impact, many more communities will have to follow Edmundston's example.
We want this to become a matter of course in the way people think about how they design streets and how they build streets.
Edmundston will be putting all of its designs and experiences online for other communities to use as a blueprint. For the Environment Report, I'm Sabri Benashour.
When you're planning a home improvement project, you can be overwhelmed with decisions about the right materials, the right quality, and the right design. Trying to keep it eco-friendly on top of everything else can add to the confusion, but Lester Graham reports it can be as simple as finding a label.
Julia Weinert and her boyfriend like the idea of making their place nice, but even something as simple as painting causes concerns.
We want to support environmentally friendly options, and we just don't want to be smelling it for 3 days out and have to be running the fans. We just want it to be convenient, and we think it would be an easy thing to do.
Well, you're in luck. We're at the local Home Depot, and we just happen to have Greenovation.tv's Matt Grokoff here. Matt, you've got some advice for her.
And it's really, really simple. When you're trying to find a paint that's healthy for you or another product, you shouldn't have to be a chemist when you go to the store. There's a really simple thing you can look for. Just look for a simple Green Guard label. Green Guard is an independent organization that lets you know with a simple label that that product is safe for you.
So none of the really strong paint smells that mean polluting chemicals are being released. Green Guard Environmental Institute sets indoor air standards for products and buildings. Julia and I sniffed a can of paint with the Green Guard label and then one without.
I'll let you sniff first.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. That is ridiculous. It smells so much stronger than this one. You can't even smell that one compared to this one.
A gallon of paint with the Green Guard label does cost a few dollars more, maybe as much as $10. Matt then herded us to another part of the store, the plumbing section, where Julia and I were confronted by all kinds of shiny chrome and brass faucets.
There's a whole wall, a whole aisle of faucets here, and I just don't know which ones to look for.
So, Matt, you got any fancy labels here?
Absolutely. Again, if you're looking for that eco-friendly option, a way to save yourself some money and some water, it's simple. Just look for the WaterSense label. The EPA does Energy Star labels for appliances. The EPA also does WaterSense label for plumbing fixtures.
WaterSense means the fixture, whether it's a faucet, a showerhead, or a toilet, will use less water but still works well. As we wandered over to the lumber section of the store, Matt told us the last label he wanted to show us is the most ignored label, and it might just be the most important one.
FSC stands for the Forest Stewardship Council, and what that means is they've made a commitment that they're not going to be tearing down forests and clear-cutting them in order for you to build some bookshelves in your home. This is one of the biggest causes of greenhouse gases, is that we don't have these forests capturing this carbon anymore. Instead of having to have a PhD in forest management, you can just simply look for a piece of wood that has an FSC label on it.
So, labels. Julie says works for her.
It's going to be great taking my boyfriend around the store and showing him all these cool things that I can get to make our home improvements a little bit more cheap and environmentally friendly.
All right, remind me, go over this again. What am I supposed to be looking for?
It's very simple. If you're looking for paint, look for GreenGuard. For plumbing, WaterSense. For lumber, FSC, Forest Stewardship Council certified.
That's Matt Grokoff with greenovation.tv. Thanks again, Matt.
Lester, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
For the Environment Report, I'm Lester Graham.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now located at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop specializes in the sales and rental of band and orchestra instruments, digital keyboards, guitars, amps, and drums, along with a wide variety of sheet music.
Earth and Sky.
Climate change is happening now. It's not a theory. It's a set of observed facts. It's affecting many of the things that people care about.
You're listening to marine ecologist Jane Lubchenco. She's head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Dr. Lubchenco told EarthSky that global climate change from fossil fuel burning is affecting Earth's oceans.
Climate change is already affecting oceans. It's making them warmer. It's making sea level rise. And it's making them more acidic.
Dr. Lubchenco gave some specific examples from NOAA research.
We know that in the North Atlantic, 24 of the 36 stocks of fish that NOAA tracks have been moving northward. So they can no longer be found where fishermen used to.